Travis Ronald is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas. Death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Ronald to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host and chief legal analyst Larry Douglas, criminal defense attorney Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Huhan Snyder, and special guest Kristen Hule, executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. The Execution Watch for Travis Ronald begins. And good evening. Today is Wednesday, December 11th, 2019. You're listening to KPFT FM Houston 90.1 Radio. You're now listening to the Execution Watch radio show. If you tuned in to listen to Arab Voices, they have been preempted by this show. We are here because Texas is preparing to execute a man. Preparing to execute Travis Runnels. I'm Larry Douglas. I'm serving as two roles here tonight. I'm serving as the host and as the legal analyst, and I'm here with Mike Gillespie. Mike and I have the responsibility of handling the show today. We've also got Linda Huhan Snyder, who's at the death house, and also Kristen Hule, the executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get into a discussion of the matter. As soon as Linda Huhan Snyder is available, we'll go to her and have her give us a little report from outside the death house. Now, as you might be aware, Execution Watch is a live news show that broadcasts only during Texas executions. So I believe I'm giving a signal that Linda is now on the phone, and she'll Linda Huhan Snyder, and she'll give us a report from what's going on the row. Linda?
I'm here.
Good evening, Linda. How are you doing today?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you okay, Linda. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay. So we just came to you for an update on what's going on the row right now. Just let our audience know generally what's going on. Set the atmosphere for us, if you would, please.
Well, as far as we know, there's no decision by the Supreme Court. At least it's not published for us to see. So there's about probably 20 people out here for Travis's side. And his aunt and uncle just arrived. Other than that, we're just waiting.
Okay, and Linda, we haven't heard anything from the Supreme Court either. So what happens now? Do you just sit and wait, or are we waiting for the Supreme Court, or what's going on there? What do they do?
We have to wait for the Supreme Court to rule before they start anything.
Okay, so
he's not even on the gurney yet. They wait until they get word from the Supreme Court, and then they have to hook him up and everything.
Okay. And is that the time at which the expression is the witnesses cross the road, or have they?
Yes, that's when they cross the road.
Okay, so for our audience, no witnesses have crossed the road as of yet because we're still waiting to hear what, if anything, the Supreme Court will do.
Yes, I will call y'all as soon as they cross the road.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like for our audience to know at this point, Linda?
No, we're just all hoping that the Supreme Court rules in our favor and lets him live, because he has things wrong with his case that need to be settled.
And we would agree with that sentiment, Linda. We're also hopeful that the Supreme Court will let Travis Ronald live.
Yes.
We'll check back with you as soon as something happens then.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. So, Michael, let's just talk about this case. The case of Travis Runnels. Now, I understand. Can we talk about where the case comes from and what exactly happened? Can we discuss that for a minute?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
I believe it happened in the Dallas area.
I think it's Amarillo. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. The prison unit was in Amarillo.
The original crime came out of Dallas.
The original crime. Okay.
About.
The original crime. But
let's talk about why he was even in prison.
Because okay.
That starts off with it.
Go right ahead.
He was in prison. He's doing 70 years on a robbery conviction. Seemed like he had an extensive criminal past. They didn't press it too much. The only part they talked about was why he was in prison. He got a 70-year sentence for robbery.
Okay, that was an aggravated robbery, correct?
Aggravated robbery.
Okay, so that's the first-degree felony, punishable by 5 to life in prison. So he was serving 70 years.
Which means he would do 35 before parole.
Okay, that's minimum 35 before he's first even eligible for parole.
So in a sense, he was under a life sentence.
Right, I mean, right.
He could have paroled out when he was an old man, but technically it would have been difficult to live that long.
Okay. So now, then, my notes say he was in Potter County in the Clements unit is where he was when this incident occurred. That's in Amarillo. He's in prison, serving a 70-year sentence,
and he's working
for aggravated robbery.
And he's working in the boot factory, and he doesn't like it there.
Okay.
He wants to be transferred to another work detail.
Okay. Yeah, I think he wanted to be a barber, whereas he was serving as a janitor in the shoe factory there inside the prison. And then what happened if you recall?
He asked to be transferred to the barber shop, and that was denied. When that was denied, he went off the deep end and basically went to kill a white person. Didn't care if it was an inmate or a guard. He was wanting to kill a white person. So he came up to the guard in charge at the boot shop and slashed his neck from behind.
Okay.
And killed him.
Okay. Now let's just talk about that for a minute, Michael, because I know I'm going off sort of on a tangent, but right now we have something called hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is a hate crime.
Now I'm not real much of a fan for hate crime legislation. I think it's totally unnecessary, but I think legislature have passed it primarily to appease black people.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to explain to black people, look, you know, this can be used against you. Okay, because I think what happened is Runnels did say, you know, I don't care who I kill.
That's right.
So long as it's a white person.
That's correct.
Now the supervisor of the shop he was working in. Now they'd had a run in the day before, and he was angry with him and said, "You know, if he says one thing to me, you know, something's going to go down, something's going to happen." And he actually bragged about, well, not bragged, but said some things about what he was going to do. You recall that?
Yeah, and I wonder if when he says he wanted to kill a white person, was it a hate crime against whites or a hate crime against the penal institution, that white people who ran the penal institution? He might not have been delineating because of race, but because of job descriptions. I'm sure he felt that he was a black man in a white-run prison.
Okay.
And being mad at the prison, mad at the man who was supervising him, mad he wasn't transferred, he wanted to get back at the prison. So when he said white, I'm not sure it was a true hate crime that he wanted to kill a white man, more than he wanted to kill somebody who was part of the white establishment who ran the prison.
Okay, but it does raise an issue.
It does raise
that's
the issue.
Not, that was an issue that was raised in this case.
That's correct.
But in any event, this is Wiley. Wiley was the person slashed his throat.
That's correct.
And then he died.
With a knife they have in the leather shop to cut leather. So it must have been a very sharp knife. It wasn't an inmate knife. It wasn't a illegal knife. It was a knife that was open in the shop to trim leather.
Okay.
And you wonder why they would allow somebody who's a danger, and the question here becomes future dangerous, to be around those kind of weapons and those kind of tools. It makes me think that he was not that much of a future danger to allow him to be around those kind of tools.
Oh yeah, he was working in the shop. He wouldn't have gotten the job in the shop if he had the propensity to be dangerous in prison. But again, he did say, you know, he was angry. He says, I'm going to get shipped one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to kill somebody. Something's going to go down. And when he killed Wiley, he says, you know, somebody asked him, you know, why'd you do it? He said, I was going to do it to somebody. And it could have been an offender, another inmate. You know, as long as the person is white.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't necessary. And when he was asked, you know, when he found out that Wiley had died, and he was asked about the consequences of that, he said, well, you know, dead man can't talk. So he was... Now, let's talk about this trial, non-trial. Can we talk about that for a minute, Michael?
It's an interesting scenario because it doesn't look like there was a trial.
What do you mean there wasn't a trial?
Well, it looks like that, again, in these kind of cases, you can't take a plea to go to the death penalty. You have to go through a formal trial. In most cases, you can get a plea for lesser punishment by letting the DA's office waive the trial, enter in a plea agreement, and take the plea agreement to the court. But you cannot do that in these kind of capital murder cases. So they could have taken death penalty off the table and let him plead out to a lesser crime, but they didn't do that. They insisted on death penalty. My understanding is you can plead guilty to the death penalty. They have to go through all the motions to prove you guilty in the first part of this trial, and the second part of the trial proves the future dangers to the jury. So you have to have a trial. You can't plea bargain on a death on a capital case.
Okay. So what we're saying here is that when we've got a death penalty case, a capital murder case where the state is seeking the death penalty, then you cannot plead
guilty. That's correct. You're correct. Even if you want to, you can't plead guilty.
Okay. So, and this was one of those cases. This is a death penalty case. This is a capital case, a capital murder case, in which the state is seeking the death penalty. So, if he's found guilty, the only possibilities are life in prison or death.
That's correct.
And in a case like that, which this was, he could not plead guilty to a judge pursuant to a plea bargain agreement with the prosecutors.
And I believe that this was before life in prison with no parole was an option.
Yes, it was. It was.
And so the trouble becomes anything that he got in lieu of death, he could have technically paroled out at some time in the future.
Okay, that would have been a possibility.
Possibility, not a probability.
So now we're talking about a man who apparently, since the state was adamant about it seeking the death penalty, that there was no plea bargain agreement that could have given him something less than the possibility of death or life in prison. They went through the procedure of selecting a jury
in a
capital case. And this is in a small county.
Mm-hmm.
And when they select a jury in a capital case, that is a long process.
Very long process.
And it requires the presence of lots of veneer persons.
Lots of jurors to be available and lots of time.
And the way the process works is the judge, as in every other case, talks to the whole group. To give some basic information and to provide information on the law in terms of qualifying the jurors. Because this was such a small county and there are so many jurors, prospective jurors, veneer persons, who are called over for the selection process, in this county they didn't have a large enough facility to hold the entire veneer panel. So they broke it up into two pieces. So there was half on one that the judge had talked to one half, and then he talked to the other half. And that led to some pretty interesting possibilities of having grounds for complaining.
In a small town, you have to continue picking up the garbage, putting out the fires. You have all kind of functions that have to be taken care of. You can't have everybody down in the courthouse picking a jury.
Okay. So that process is really pretty interesting too, because in the small towns, when you've got that many prospective jurors called in, there's a possibility. I don't know if this ever happened to you, Mike, but it's happened to me when I go to small towns. A lot of times, the prosecutors and the defense lawyers know the people who are on the jury.
I will tell you, one of my early jury trials in Cold Spring, Texas. It bothered me when my opposing lawyer from Houston knew every member of the jury panel and asked about their kids and their brothers and their fathers, and I realized I was in trouble being from Brooklyn with somebody who was raised in that small town. But it's hard to understand how one attorney can know everybody on a personal first-name basis on the entire jury panel. But that's the way it is sometimes.
These are small towns, and a lot of the jurors have served on juries before. That was an issue in this case, too, because one person was removed because she had been on a jury that had found somebody not guilty earlier. So they go through this entire process of selecting the jury. And so once the jury is selected and the charge is read to the defendant, then the defendant enters a plea before the jury.
Guilty.
Now, and the plea is either guilty or not guilty. And so when the defendant enters a plea of not guilty, we proceed with the guilt-innocence phase of the trial.
That's correct.
But if the defendant enters a plea of guilty, which is to the jury, which is the only place he can enter the plea of guilty, is before the jury, because he can't do it before a judge. So the law requires him to enter the plea, whatever his plea is, to the jury. In this case, he enters a plea of guilty to the jury. And now the jury, after having, if the jury should receive the plea of guilty, then the jury has to decide on the punishment phase. Now, do you know what would be the advantage of anybody entering a plea of guilty in any case, but especially a capital case?
Well, first of all, the jury has no option besides find him guilty, because there's been no evidence presented that he is innocent. The only evidence they hear is that he says he's guilty, and that's it. So the jury has to come back with a plea of guilty. There is reasons to do this. The main reason to do this is that many times when you have a case, what you're looking at is trying to get probation from a jury, not penitentiary time.
Or just any kind of leniency.
Any kind of leniency.
Clearly he wouldn't have been entitled to probation.
Sure. But on a simple case, if the state wants penitentiary time and you want probation, an old trick that lawyers do is go to trial on guilt and innocence and do exactly this. Have your client stand up and plead guilty. It's a very effective position, because if the person to make the decision of, say, probation or prison time is that jury panel, the argument is that when you go to court and you plead not guilty, and then they bring all this evidence in to show you did it, the jury is less sympathetic to you when you now come back at the second stage of the trial and say, oh yeah, I lied to you the first time, I did do it, cut me a break and give me probation. There's a strong argument that's saying the jury is more likely to give you probation if from the moment you get, you saying, how do you plead? I did it, I'm sorry, there's an explanation why I did it, I just want probation. There's an argument that a jury is more sympathetic to somebody that comes across like that, number one. Number two, from a trial viewpoint, what you do is catch the DAs off track. The DAs are working and getting ready for guilt or innocence. They're getting police officers ready. They're getting medical evidence ready. They're getting all their evidence ready for the first week of trial, and you just pled guilty. Well, the moment you plead guilty, the second stage starts up. They're not ready for that.
Okay. They don't
have witnesses ready for that. They are not prepared for that. They're prepared to bring in the evidence that you did it.
Okay.
But what do they do when you admit you did it? Now guilt or innocence start. How are they going to handle that? Are they ready for it? It's an interesting theory. The big one to me is, I think it's more sympathetic to a jury, especially a case like that, that they were probably told it was going to take weeks and weeks and weeks to hear the evidence. They got to look kindly about the man that didn't want to waste their time. He admitted he did it. Let's talk about him admitting he did it.
The strategic step that he's taking here. Now, we're talking about a death penalty case. So if he's looking for leniency from this jury, the leniency would be, if I admit that what I did, perhaps they will not give me the death penalty, because the only choice is life in prison or death.
That's right. And I don't see how he could have won the case on guilt or innocence when it happened in the prison unit, when there was witnesses, when there were statements. It was not a winning case for guilt or innocence.
Okay, so you're saying that by pleading guilty to the jury, from a tactical standpoint, that might have made them look at him more favorably for not wasting their time.
I think I think even if they gave him the death penalty, they're looking at more favorably for not wasting their time, and more favorably by coming forth and admitting. You know, it's one thing to murder somebody in hot blood, but the other argument is now I'm in court, is now hot blood. I've taken an oath on the Bible to tell the truth, and the truth is I did it, and I'm guilty. There's a lot of things to argue about that.
But the objective in this case likely would be I'm trying to get this jury to give me life in
prison.
That's
correct. And I think it's a smart move to make. It's one that can be roundly criticized because you did nothing. But looking back on it, I think it's a smart move. It's a move that I've seen works many, many times.
Okay. And in this case, what happened was Travis Runnels did plead guilty to the jury. And once he pled guilty to the jury, then the judge excused the jury to make sure that the plea was voluntarily made. So once he pled guilty to the jury, the judge excused the jury and had a question and answer session with Travis Runnels on the record to make sure that his plea was voluntarily made and to make sure that he understood the consequences of his plea. So there was an exchange between Travis Runnels and the judge where the judge asked him the kinds of questions, you know, do you understand the consequences of your plea? You do understand, Mr. Runnels, that on your plea of guilty, now the judge can't take the plea of guilty, but the jury can. But what the judge does procedurally is the judge explains to Runnels that I've got to tell this jury that I've got to instruct this jury to find you guilty because that's the only evidence that the jury has before it is your plea of guilty.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's a plea of guilty and a judicial confession. You're confessing in open court that I committed this offense and I committed each and every element of the offense. So the judge makes sure, one, that he is competent to enter the plea, and that he understands the consequences of the plea, and that he's doing it voluntarily. And further, Mr. Runnels not only answered the judge's questions to indicate that he was sane and competent, but he also gave the judge an affidavit confessing that he committed the offense. Says, Judge, I'm knowingly doing this. So I'm doing this to full knowledge. And so the only choice the judge has at this point is to, well, the judge could not find him guilty, but the judge had to instruct the jury to find him guilty. Now I'm being given signals that we've got a guest on the line, Kristen. I'm going to make sure that I pronounce this last name correctly. This Hule. Okay, that's the name. Kristen Hule, who is the executive director of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. That sounds like an extremely important task that she has here, and we'd like to just talk to her just for a few minutes. Kristen, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Could you tell this? We're here on KPFT-FM Houston 90.1. We have this show called Execution Watch. I think you might be familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
And we are here for the execution that we don't know what's going to happen yet with Mr. Travis Runnels. But we're waiting for the Supreme Court to speak on it. But I think now is a good time, especially now as we're closing the year, when Texas had a pretty active year, but not nearly as active as it has been and could have been. Let's just talk about from your perspective, from the perspective of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Yes, so there have been a lot of really significant death penalty developments in Texas in 2019. At one point, you know, back in August, we were facing, I think, 13 execution dates from mid-August, you know, through tonight's scheduled execution. And, you know, thankfully, a number of those executions were stayed or given reprieves. So far, you know, the state of Texas has executed 8 people, which is out of the 21 executions that have happened nationwide. So, you know, while things have improved in terms of the numbers, at least in Texas in recent years, you're still very much an outlier among all other states that have the death penalty in the United States in terms of the frequency of, with which the state carries out executions. Last year in 2018, the state of Texas put 13 people to death, and so this year it'll be, you know, either 8 or 9, depending on what happens tonight. So certainly, you know, glad for that drop, although, of course, we regret all of the lives lost to the Texas death penalty system this year. In terms of the, you know, out of these 21 execution dates we had altogether in 2019, there were 10 stays granted by state or federal courts and then 2 dates withdrawn. So I think that was a really significant development. And, you know, thankfully, a number of individuals, you know, with innocence claims, intellectual disability claims, you know, claims of religious discrimination impacting the proceedings of their trials, you know, many of these individuals received stays on those grounds.
Okay, Kristen, could you tell our viewers, our listeners, just a little bit about the organization itself, the Texas Coalition? What is your task? What do you guys do?
Sure. So TCADP is a statewide grassroots advocacy organization. We're based in Austin. We have thousands of members throughout the state of Texas. And, you know, our mission is to end the death penalty in Texas. And so we pursue our mission by working to stop executions, to prevent new death sentences, and to educate the public about the realities of the Texas death penalty system. We also advocate for change with elected officials on the county and state level.
And if someone wanted to contact you or somebody wanted to get involved in what you do, do you accept volunteers? I mean, how does that work?
Yes, we have a whole host of ideas for involvement on our website. We encourage anyone interested in becoming involved in our organization to subscribe to our email list. That's the best way we can let them know about opportunities in their area, such as upcoming events, on, you know, any actions that we're taking on specific cases or work we're doing at the legislature, for example. Just go to our website, which is tcadp.org, so just the acronym of our organization, .org. And you can also find us on social media. On Twitter, we're at tcadp. DOTORG, and then also on Facebook.
Great. Okay, so and in terms of developments for next year, what are you guys' plans? What are your goals?
Well, we're keeping a really close eye on some important district attorney elections. Voters in Harris, El Paso, and Travis counties, among others, will have an opportunity to cast a vote for district attorney. So we know there's some contested primary elections in all of those counties, and then of course the general election in November. We know that district attorneys are the linchpin of the criminal justice system. The elected district attorney makes decisions about everything impacting the criminal justice system in their county. As far as our issue, you know, they make the decision to whether to charge an individual with capital murder, and then whether or not whether they plan to seek the death penalty for that person. And so it's an incredibly important elected office. We are a nonpartisan organization, so we don't get involved directly in elections, but what we focus on is engaging our members and letting them know about opportunities to interact with district attorney candidates, to ask them questions about their approach to the death penalty, their views on capital punishment, and then, you know, we work to hold these district attorneys accountable once they're elected, and to continue to convey community concerns about the death penalty. We also are really excited about our 2020 annual conference, which will be taking place in San Antonio on February 29th, 2020. We have a lot of amazing speakers lined up, including Roderick Reed and Juana Akpan, who will be our keynote speakers. We'll be hearing from the current district attorney of Bexar County, which includes San Antonio, as well as a former district attorney, Sam Millsap. And we're going to be honoring some really extraordinary individuals, including former Texas Court of Criminal Appeals Judge Elsa Alcala, Rick McCarty with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship of Texas, and the filmmakers of The Penalty, a really important documentary film that screened throughout Texas this year. And we'll be honoring also Quincy McNeil, who is part of the legal team for Rodney Reed.
Now, tell us about the conference itself. How long does it last? If somebody who's listening right now says, I want to go, I mean, how do you go about doing it if they can at all?
Sure. So it's a one-day conference. So it'll be on Saturday, February 29th, which is Leap Day. It lasts from about 9 o'clock in the morning till 4 o'clock at night. I'm sorry, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And we also have opportunities for people who can only attend part of the conference. So we offer either a full day registration or just a ticket for the awards luncheon and keynote address. So all of those options are on our website again, which is tcadp.org, and then you click on what we do, an annual conference, or there's also a link directly from the homepage to the conference page that gives all the details about it.
Okay. And are there any other plans for 2020 other than the conference? What else is going on?
Well, we will continue our day-to-day work provide whatever assistance we can to stop executions. You know, at this point, there are already 7 execution dates on the schedule, so we'll be closely monitoring all those cases and providing whatever support we can to raise the important issues in those cases and work to stop them. We'll also be continuing to monitor new capital cases around the state to track whether or not prosecutors are seeking the death penalty in those cases. And we'll be doing what we can to resolve other cases with outcomes other than the death penalty. And then, of course, we'll be continuing our really important public education work through film screening events and presentations by voices of experience, people who've been impacted directly by the death penalty and violence. We'll continue to be informing the media about new death penalty developments and other important information related to this issue, and continuing to build support among the public and to recruit more supporters to this cause.
In terms of the case that's pending this evening, the Travis Runnels case, do you have any words you'd like to share with our listening audience regarding that case specifically?
Well, I think that the case of Travis Runnels is very disturbing on many levels. The fact that his defense attorney did not present any mitigating evidence on his behalf during the punishment phase of the trial was then compounded by the state's witness, AP Marilot, who provided blatantly false testimony on that very critical issue of future dangerousness. He provided the jury with false information about the prison classification system and essentially misled them into believing that if Travis Runnels was sentenced to life in prison, that he would have unrestricted movement and would be essentially free to commit acts of violence, and that just simply was not true. Individuals convicted of capital murder and sentenced to life in prison would be placed under, or are placed under, very strict conditions of confinement. So I think that scared the jury into sentencing Travis Runnels to death, and it's a travesty that the courts to date have not looked at that issue. And it just shows kind of the inconsistency of the way the courts tend to handle these cases. We had two other men executed this year who for whom AP Marilla also testified at their trials and provided similarly false information about prison classification system, and you know, they were not able to secure relief on those claims either. On the other hand, you know, there have been two individuals who raised this claim previously and who did get relief from the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals several years ago. So I'm deeply troubled by that. And, you know, the fact is in Travis Reynolds' case, apparently the state has agreed that the testimony provided by Marilat was false, but they don't think that it was significant. But it was significant because in the void of any other mitigating evidence at his trial, I think the jury was really left with very little to sway their deliberations towards sparing Travis Reynolds' life. I also was very moved by the letters of support that Travis Reynolds' attorneys presented in the application for clemency they filed with the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. This young man clearly has had an impact on many people who correspond with him and visit with him, and whose lives will be diminished, you know, if he is put to death tonight.
Yeah, it sort of makes you wonder. I mean, the two people you were talking about earlier who did receive the death penalty in Texas, AP Marilat testify in their cases, were mm-hmm. Billy Wayne Cabo and Robert Sparks. It raises the issue of consistency more so than anything. But so far, we still haven't heard anything from the Supreme Court, and we're just waiting. Number eight, we're still on number eight. Maybe we'll get to number nine. Is there?
Mm-hmm. Hey, I just saw a tweet that they denied, or that they did not. They denied his petition for writ and denied the stay of execution,
and
according to Darryl McCullough.
Our producer, Elizabeth Stein, is saying something to me regarding the Supreme Court.
Right. Sorry to interrupt. Larry, I did just hear from the Supreme Court just now, and they said that the court did just issue a ruling, and they did turn down Mr. Reynolds.
Okay.
So the execution has been okayed to go forward.
Okay, and I think Kristen was saying pretty much the same thing, correct, Kristen? You just heard that also?
Yes, I just saw a tweet from Julie McCullough at the Texas Tribune that the application for a stay was denied, and that they will not consider his appeal related to the issue of false testimony.
Okay. So with that, I'm sure we'll be getting an update from Linda Hujan Snyder, who's in at the death house now,
mm-hmm.
and we'll continue to discuss the case. Any parting words of wisdom for us tonight, Ms. Hule?
You know, these are very difficult nights. Every time there's an execution in Texas, you know, but I still have a lot of optimism that we are on the path towards eliminating use of the death penalty in Texas. You know, the death penalty is declining here, certainly not as quickly or as soon as any of us would like, but it is declining. And so I do think that we have to persevere, and we will reach our ultimate mission of ending the death penalty in Texas. And I thank everyone who listens to your program and to all of you for putting it together. And thank you for having me on.
Okay. And before you go, Kristen, mm-hmm. would you give those your contact information again for those who might not have caught it, for the Texas Coalition?
Sure. Our website is www.tcadp.org, and that's the best way to connect with us, also through Facebook and Twitter, and you know, all of our email addresses and phone number are on that website as well.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you're still listening to the Execution Watch radio program here on KPFT FM Houston 90.1. We, as we said just a minute ago, got the news from the Supreme Court that they are permitting the death sentence against Travis Trevino Runnels to be carried out. So we expect that we'll be hearing from Linda Hujan Schneider shortly in terms of what's going on there at the death house. So, Michael, I guess we can continue on our discussion. We were talking about the fact that Travis Runnels and his lawyers exercised the tactic, the trial tactic, apparently, of entering a plea of guilty to a capital murder case in which the state of Texas was seeking the death penalty. That can only be done, only be received by a jury. The judge can't make that decision, but the judge does, under the law, direct the jury to find him guilty based on his plea of guilty. And so we were talking about the fact that the judge had to admonish him on the record, explaining and making sure that Mr. Runnels understood and voluntarily entered that plea of guilty and that he was competent to enter the plea.
You know, it's one of those legal points that the judge did it by the book. I mean, the judge did everything the appellate court says you're supposed to do. But in looking at it, what the judge almost did is ask questions for his own curiosity. Are you sure you want to do this? Why are you doing this? Do you know what you're doing? The questions they asked were common sense questions that a judge would ask somebody who's voluntarily pleading guilty and taking a chance for the death penalty. So I think the judge did a good job, not only following the law, but following his conscience in terms of making sure the man knew what he was doing. And I think he did know what he was doing. I think his lawyer advised him to do it. But again, I don't know what the lawyer could have done for guilt or innocence on this case to have the client found innocent. It was a laid-down case. I think it was a smart move to make to get the jury ready for some kind of mercy. What I don't understand is why, I understand why he did nothing at trial, but let's talk about the punishment stage, because that's the part I don't understand. If you're pleading, if you're letting your client take the plea of guilty at trial for punishment, it seems like you should have done more punishment than doing nothing.
Okay, and that's where we are now. We believe. Now, let me say a little bit about the judges, because not only was this judge, did the judge do a good job. Michael, I know it's been my experience, and I assume it's probably yours, that at every level of the legal system, the judges do a good job of admonishing people, whether it's a plea of guilty or a plea of not guilty going to a jury. Judges, for the most part, manage their courts.
I think that's the case, especially on cases like this. They might get slack on routine DWIs and family assaults and misdemeanor thefts, but not on these kind of cases. This is a serious case with a lot of press, a lot of publicity. Judges are elected officials. Anything he can do to get before the camera and be a good judge is a good thing to do. I think he did everything right. I can't criticize the judge at all for what he did.
Okay. Clearly, the more serious the case, the more serious the...
The more press coverage, the more press is there, the more publicity is there, and the judge wants to be on center stage and doing his job properly.
And you mentioned that it appeared to you, based on seeing the exchange between the judge and Mr. Runnels, that the judge appeared to be even concerned for Mr. Runnels himself to make sure that he's knowingly doing what he's doing.
He asked the questions that seems like he was curious. Do you know what you're doing? Are you doing the right thing? Have you thought about this? He seems to be asking the questions not from the legal book, but from the viewpoint of a judge who was puzzled why somebody would plead guilty to a capital crime and making sure he knew what he was doing. I think the judge did a good job.
Okay, capital crime, capital murder in which the state is seeking the death penalty. We have Travis Runnels pleading guilty, and it's in all cases, criminal cases, we have both the guilt-innocence phase, which Mr. Runnels pretty much waived, And now we got the punishment phase. In a punishment phase in a capital murder case, the outcomes are only two outcomes. That is life in prison
or death penalty.
Or death. Right. In Texas, pretty much by lethal injection.
But at that time, it wasn't life in prison with no parole.
No, correct.
Okay, so whatever life in prison meant, he could have gotten out again, which is why they now changed the law so jurors know it's life without parole. So okay. They're gone for good.
So the decision is at the punishment phase, this jury who has now found him guilty at the direction of the judge, based on his plea of guilty, is now trying to decide what should his punishment be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they don't just say life or death, okay? What they do, they have to answer questions that look like civil questions. These are what are called special issues, okay? And the primary special issue in this case now is future danger. Is Reynolds going to be a future danger to society?
Before we get to that, I think the other question that should be brought up is, did the lawyer put on any mitigating evidence to show things to this person's background, like fetal syndrome, his mother drank too much when he was a child, was he abused as a child? They need to bring in his past to show the kind of person he was to mitigate what he did.
Right. And that would be the flip side of the future danger. That would be the defensive side.
That's correct.
So the state brings its case in chief, its case on punishment, and the state's case on punishment is likely to be he is a future danger.
And in this case, what the lawyer made is all the typical claims we make, he's a violent alcoholic, he didn't attend schools, was abused by his family mentally and physically, and sexually abused. The lawyer actually brought in Mr. Reynolds' mother, father, grandmother to Amarillo to go to court to testify in
now,
his behalf.
We're talking the defense lawyer?
The defense lawyer brought them to court.
Okay.
And prepped them for going on trial.
Okay.
Unexplained, in the middle of the trial, they left and went home. So he had no witnesses.
Okay. So, in a criminal case, the state has the burden of proof.
That's correct.
So they get to go first and last in some cases. So the state would have put on its case before the defense gets a chance to put on its
case. That's correct.
Okay, so the state's case would have been primarily saying Travis Reynolds is a future danger. Okay, and so they put on information claiming that Travis Reynolds is a future danger. And then after that, the defense had the chance to put on mitigating evidence.
That's correct.
Okay. So now the defense having already pled guilty, so now the real issue is
mitigating evidence.
Mitigating evidence after the future danger evidence has been put on.
That's
so let's
correct.
Just talk a little bit about the future danger, because everybody's talking about the main thing we're talking about on future danger.
What I don't understand is why does this come up so late? It seems like it's all they had, and I don't see this as being a real issue.
Why does what come up so late, Michael?
What I understand is the idea of this man being a bad witness was one of the last appellate points that was brought up. It wasn't brought up to keep him from the witness stand by the original lawyers. It wasn't brought up by the original appellate lawyers. It seemed like a last-ditch effort to save his life.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say, Michael, is we're talking about Marillat, the
expert. That's correct.
Okay. Can do that right now. Just for the people who are listening, let me just repeat that we are, for those who are tuned in for Arab Voices, it's not here tonight. We're now doing the KPFT's Execution Watch. We encourage our listeners not only to listen, but to be actively involved if you should choose to do so. And to contact us in the various different kinds of communications. We also like to interview the people who have dates. The way this works is Elizabeth Stein Elizabeth, do you want to do the appeal or let me
do sure.
it? Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. No, I just wanted to give everybody an update about what's happening because we get so many requests from listeners to do more interviews with convicts who are on death row. And basically what I wanted to explain is that it's really up to the folks on death row if they want to be interviewed. And this is really us offering them an opportunity. This all started with Sarge years ago, who invited us up to interview him. And then we played that and decided that it went so well that it would help our listeners to be able to get to know the folks we're talking about and to help them understand, in most cases, how the guys had changed quite a bit between the time they now and the time they arrived on the row. But, you know, in Texas, I don't know if folks know this, but we already have 7 executions scheduled for 2020, going through the month of May. So a few days ago, I sent out invitations. In fact, we're able to email the convicts by going through a service called JPay, and the guards print them out and give them to the convicts. And so I sent 7 letters inviting guys with dates to have us come and interview them for 20 minutes about anything they want to talk about, and that if they have an execution, that we would play their interview uncut and unedited during that show. We've done that quite a few times, and people really are very interested in those, which is good to see. So I just wanted to let the listeners know about that, and also anybody on death row who's listening know that there should be an invitation coming from me and for them to decide if they want to invite us to do an interview with them, and if so, to let the CO know or whoever comes to poll them.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Elizabeth. And on that point, just let me say that we try to keep you informed as our listening audience, but the whole idea of interviewing someone who has a date with the executioner, our feeling on that is an individual's choice. And we make the opportunity available, but by no means is any we let people know if you have something you want to say, but if you don't want to say anything, we understand that too. And if the execution proceeds, then and only then do we air the interview. If the execution is stayed or postponed or whatever, we do not air the interview. So, but it's just to keep our audience informed, not to entertain you, but to keep you informed. If someone on the row has a desire to make comments, we make that available to them. We're getting close to the end, Michael. So, and we have a call now. I guess this is from Linda.
Yes. Hi, Larry. The witnesses are crossing the road now.
Okay. What's the mood like, Linda?
Very somber right now. The guards are, there's hundreds of guards here, and they're waiting to just cheer, I guess, when it happens. I mean, there's people from Polanski here. The major's here. They're all just, and none of them will look at us or talk to us. And they act like they don't know us when they know every one of us.
But, Linda, you're not saying that they actually cheer when this happens, do you? They don't do that, do they?
I think they're probably that's the mood that they're portraying to us that they're going to do.
Okay.
So I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
I hope they don't. But
well, we were hoping that we'd done our last one last time, but apparently this appears to be the last one for the year 2019. This is number 9. Thank you for your update, Linda. And we look forward to closing out the year with no more. And maybe we'll be able to get either stays or reversals for all of those that are planned for next year.
Yes, I hope so.
And any parting words for 2019 from you, Linda?
I just hope the death penalty ends soon. And I feel like they're stacking all these people to be executed because they know it's coming to an end. And they're just trying to get everybody they can. That's my opinion.
Understood. Okay. Well, you take care now.
All right. Thank you. Good night.
Good night. We've got just a few minutes, and I think, Michael, you want to close us out?
Yeah. The where we left off was the mitigating punishment. Again, the lawyer called in the father, the mother, the grandmother to testify for this young man. For some reason, they left the courthouse in the middle of the trial. I don't know why they left the courthouse, but that's why the lawyer was stuck with nothing to testify to. There's many reasons they could have left. Maybe he did not like what they were going to say. Maybe he found out they were going to say something that was going to be impeached. Maybe. I personally wonder why they would leave their loved one out there with nobody to speak up for them. Now, what I want to get to now, which I consider to be important, is we got to remember something Ray used to always say. The important part of this situation is that we're not killing the man who committed the crime. We're killing the man 20 years after the crime. All the arguments here is about how he was a changed man. He started reading. He started writing. He started doing things to help other people. That's the key to this. If we need to do anything to change the law, is we need to make the decision on future dangerousness just before the execution. We don't need to make it when the crime happens and everybody's upset. The question becomes, is just before he's executed, who are we executing?
And that'll have to be the last word this evening, Michael. This is the Execution Watch radio show. Tune in. We hope we don't have an execution in January, but our next... and I don't have that information on the next execution planned, but it will be sometime in January if indeed we do have one. This is Larry Douglas with Mike Gillespie. Elizabeth Stein is our producer. Otis McClay is our technical director. Don Freeman is our engineer. Thank you for tuning in, and we hope not to ever have to do one of these shows again. Good night.
January 15th.
January 15th is the next execution. Scheduled. We hope it does not happen.
People of Texas, children of God. It's insane. In Jesus' name.